Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
As there is a doll on the thumbnail of this broadcast, maybe it's appropriate that we begin with a story about a famous haunted doll, sometimes called a living doll because of its size, about 3 feet tall, and filled with straw. Robert the Doll was manufactured in Germany a long time ago, well over 100 years ago, and he was purchased by a man who was vacationing there. He returned to the United States and he gave the doll to his grandson, Robert Jean Otto. And little Robert Jean Otto was known by his friends by his middle name. They called him Jean. And Jean gave his own first name to Robert the Doll. A century later, Robert the Doll is still around. It wears a sailor's outfit that's said to have actually been Jean's childhood clothes when he was the boy owner in the early 1900s. Jean grew up in a troubled household. His parents were affluent, very well off, but cruel toward others of lower station, especially the servants of the house. It's said that one serving girl, who was on staff at the house, was so badly mistreated that she drew upon her knowledge of the dark arts, and she imbued the doll with malevolent power. It was soon after that that the strange occurrences began. His parents would hear him. Little Jean would be upstairs in his room, with the door open, talking openly to the doll. Not so unusual. What was unusual is that they heard a voice in response, a voice that sounded nothing like Jean's. The house frequently saw accidents and injuries. When it seemed like Jean was the culprit, he would just point to this 3-foot shape of cloth and straw with this unnerving smile on its face, and he would say, "Robert did it." Passers-by outside would say they looked up at the upstairs window and they swore that they saw the eyes of Robert the Doll watching them as they passed by. As Jean got older, his parents passed away. Jean began a family of his own, right there in the house, stayed on the property, and his new wife was, for obvious reasons, unsettled by this thing in her domain. She wanted to lock the doll in the attic, but her husband reportedly flew into a rage at this suggestion. He insisted Robert retain a room all his own. The doll must have his own bedroom, you know, so he can look out the window and see onto the street. But the disquiet grew, noises in the house, the walking sounds in empty hallways, demonic laughter slicing through quiet gatherings. People would just stop as they heard this awful, hideous laughing from an unoccupied portion of the house. Finally, even Jean decided that Robert the Doll had to be put away, out of sight. Now, why he did not remove him from the house, I do not know. Why he did not destroy the doll, I do not know. But Jean locked Robert the Doll in a large trunk in the attic. Then he climbed down the attic ladder, and he walked down the stairway to the first floor of the house, and when he looked to his left, in the rocking chair in the living room, there was Robert the Doll. and it is said that Robert would never allow himself to be locked away. Every time he was put away, secured away somewhere, he would almost immediately reappear in a place of his own choosing. Gene Otto finally died in 1972. Another family bought that house. Their 10-year-old girl, who even now, decades later, is a middle-aged adult, steadfastly claims that she saw the doll come alive with the intent to murder her. And she can still feel those moments of terror and danger down to her bones. Robert the doll is still around, my friends. He's on display at the East Martello Museum in Florida. He sits in a small room surrounded by glass, and he's ironically sitting comfortably on a small rocking chair with this disturbing sort of smile on its face. People flock to this exhibit so they themselves can get a first-hand look at the living doll, and you can do the same. Just make sure you don't take a photograph of Robert the doll without asking for his permission to do so first. Because it is said that if you take a photograph without permission, you will be cursed, that hex only broken if you return to that place and look through the museum glass and beg for Robert's forgiveness. And sometimes, even then, that forgiveness won't be granted, and you will spend the rest of your life under the shadow of a curse. The museum says it receives letters from people all over the country who have visited and snapped photos without permission, and then their lives simply, literally, went to hell. They wrote letters and sent them to the museum so that those letters might be read to Robert the doll, letters begging for forgiveness, so that their lives might be turned right again. Go ahead, do a Google search, an image search for Robert the doll. Look at the expression on Robert the doll's face. Look at his size and his shape, the unnerving impression he gives. And then ask yourself if this is something you would ever want living inside your house. Dolls are just scary anyway, aren't they? I guess probably the most famous doll as of late would be Annabelle, made famous by supposed paranormal researchers and investigators Ed and Lorraine Warren, on which the Conjuring films are based. Annabelle actually part of that particular franchise. And Annabelle's a scary-ass doll. Very scary doll. And Annabelle is actually part of a real story that involved the Warrens and an investigation, one of the most notorious haunted dolls in recent memory. Let me back up and start with the Warrens. It was 1952. Ed and Lorraine founded the New England Society for Psychic Research, the oldest ghost hunting group in New England. And they authored several books and gave lectures all around the world. And they claimed to have investigated over 10,000 cases of paranormal activity in their lifetime, allegedly among the first to investigate the Amityville Horror, on which the book and the films are based. Now, of course, as skeptics, you and I look at Ed and Lorraine Warren with a raised eyebrow, and we should. But this broadcast is not about the Warrens. This is about the legends that so often color our enjoyment of the Halloween holiday. Back to Annabelle. It was said she was picked up from a secondhand hobby store by a couple of roommates, Donna and Annie. And as soon as they brought her back to the apartment, the doll began manifesting bizarre behavior. They'd leave the room and claim that they came back and she was in a different location. They started to find handwritten notes scrawled on parchment paper all around the apartment, although neither of them used parchment paper for anything. One day, Donna came home from work and she found Annabelle on her bed with blood on her hands, allegedly emanating from the doll itself. Annabelle is now under glass on display at the Warren home. Interestingly, apparently you can go see Annabelle for yourself. You can sort of take a tour of this glass case that is protected with sprinkles of holy water. And it said the admission price is only $169. Another frightening doll story is linked to a real-world occurrence, the story of the Donner Party. They were stuck in a snowstorm and they ran out of food, and before long they began to eat each other. Among the Donner Party was a girl. Her name was Patty Reed, who had a little doll whose eyes were always open. And while the doll itself has never manifested any kind of agency itself, this doll apparently bore witness to the cannibalism, to the eating of human flesh that happened at the Donner Party tragedy. And now, as this silent witness to human horrors, they say that the memory of the Donner Party days resides inside her eyes. I'm going to go ahead and play you a full chapter from my new book, Ghost Stories, Original Tales, and Ghostly Urban Legends. For two reasons. One is that I thought it would be a nice addition to the broadcast, and two, I really hope that you'll enjoy it enough that you will, sort of after tasting the morsel, go and enjoy the entire meal, supporting me on Audible, Amazon, or iTunes, which is where the book is available. It is a story that we did actually a few years ago, but I always sort of heard it in my mind with a voice other than my own. It just sounded different in my skull, and so I went back and sort of reformatted and reimagined it. It is based on an actual occurrence or legend, and it's given voice here by a hugely talented storyteller who I'm honored to have participate and be a part of the audiobook. Her name is Beth Stewart. I hope you find the story as compelling as I did.
Back in 1908, the facility was called Alabama Girls Industrial School, and sophomore student Condi Cunningham lived on the fourth floor of the main residence hall. Late one night, Condi and her friends fired up a cooking burner to make hot fudge inside the dorm. Burners were against the rules, but Condi and her friends didn't care. They usually did whatever they wanted, and the resident assistants never caught them anyway. The four girls sat on Condi's bed with the cooker propped on the nightstand when the second curfew bell rang. Second bell meant they had 3 minutes until the RA did the nightly room check. The girls sprang to their feet and ran toward their own rooms when someone's foot accidentally knocked the flaming burner on its side. The bed caught fire. And so did Condi Cunningham's nightgown. Condi screamed with panic, jumped off of the bed, out the open door, and ran down the hallway screaming for help. She didn't think to drop and roll, or to snuff out the flames with a blanket or coat. She did not realize that, by running, she was fanning the flames that were burning her alive. Condi's flaming body thrashed up and down the hallway, her cries of agony piercing every door, every wall, every stairwell. Her friends watched, helpless, as Condi finally collapsed, her dead body still burning on the floor. The school adopted several names in the years after the tragedy. Alabama Girls Industrial School became Alabama Girls Technical Institute and College for Women in 1919. 4 years later, it was known as Alabama State College for Women. The addition of male students in 1956 saw the moniker simplified to Alabama College, and the school ultimately became the University of Montevallo in 1969. Throughout each of the school's incarnations, the terrible and tragic death of Condi Cunningham and reports about the ghost of the burning girl has followed it. Since that fateful night in 1908, it has been said that Condi Cunningham's tormented spirit haunts the fourth floor of the old residence hall. Students living on that floor have reported hearing terrible screams echoing through the building at night. Others have heard feet running up and down an empty fourth-floor hallway. Some have heard a disembodied female voice begging, "Help me." Late one night, A student staying in Condi's old room reported hearing noises outside of her door. When she opened the door to investigate, she was shocked to see a fiery apparition running down the hallway, its figure charred and blackened, a plume of flames fueled by burning skin. When the frightened student retreated back into her dorm and turned around, she saw her own bed on fire. The next day, she left the school and never came back. Of all the supernatural stories surrounding this girl on fire, perhaps the strangest involves the door of Condi's old room. In the days directly after her death, her friends swore that they could see the image of Condi's burning face in the pattern of the door's wood. The face was so unnerving to the students that the university had the old door replaced. But on the day after the replacement door was installed, a familiar pattern emerged in the wood. The image of Condi Cunningham mid-scream. And when the desperate school administration installed yet another replacement, the burning girl's face appeared in the wood a third time. The tormented face was so unsettling for the students that the university ultimately decided to remove the door completely. Rumor has it that the door is locked in a storage closet somewhere, the face still there, still screaming, and the doorless room currently sits empty. The students too afraid to go inside. Today, many on the fourth floor at the University of Montevallo swear that they've seen doors open and close by themselves, or that they've seen or felt a presence inside their rooms. One terrified student reported water suddenly bursting from her dorm room shower and the harrowing screams of someone burning alive, desperately trying to quench the flames. Still others are afraid to walk the fourth floor hallways at the bell of second curfew. For those who do, swear that they can hear the sound of a scream. A scream which began in 1908. The harrowing scream of Condi Cunningham, who, within these halls, will forever be the burning girl.
There are some interesting legends surrounding many of our institutions of higher learning. For example, there are famous stories from Cambridge, where students believe they've seen a floating head in the hallways. The head of none other than Oliver Cromwell, who served as Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Ireland from 1653 until his death. Oliver Cromwell had died at the age of 59 in September of 1658. He died of illness, but interestingly, because of his political reputation, his body was exhumed from Westminster Abbey on the 30th of January, 1661, and his body was subjected to a posthumous execution. His body was hanged in chains in London and then thrown into a pit. His head was cut off and displayed on a pole outside Westminster Hall until 1685, and then the head was owned by several different people, including a documented sale of his head in 1814 to a man named Josiah Henry Wilkinson, and it was publicly exhibited like a museum display before finally being buried beneath the floor of the antechapel at Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, in the year 1960. And today, students say that his head, haunts the campus grounds, searching for the rest of his body, looking for reunion with the rest of his body so that he might once again be made whole. Interestingly, there's a death mask of Oliver Cromwell on display at Warwick Castle. I have to wonder if the mask was made before or after Cromwell's head was removed from its body. When I come back here in just a second, we're going to explore the story of a town called 1234. I've got the suicide, or was it murder, of famous 1950s television actor George Reeves, who played Superman. And an original story to cap the broadcast, a story about a monster under your bed. All that plus a good haunted hotel story on the other side of this. In the spirit of today's broadcast, I've got a recommendation for you, my friends. It is a course called Death, Dying, and the Afterlife. It's taught by Dr. Mark Berkson, and he talks frankly about a subject we're often kind of weird about, right? Our own mortality, the fears of dying, losing those we love, and then dealing with that loss, the rituals surrounding death, and the therapeutic role of ritual in cultures around the world. NDEs, you know, the near-death experience or after-death where people say they went off into the spirit world and came back to tell us the story. And of course, the controversy and debate surrounding NDEs. We talk again about suicide and the stigma around it. Religious teachings on death from the Abrahamic faiths to Eastern religious traditions. And probably most relevant in my own life, it's how a temporary, finite life makes every moment so critical. Death, Dying, and the Afterlife. Just one of thousands of lectures available right now at The Great Courses Plus, and you can learn about any subject that interests you, from science to foreign language, to diet and nutrition, to piano lessons, streaming right there to your computer, your TV, your smartphone, or listen like you would a podcast on The Great Courses app. I really think you're going to love The Great Courses Plus as much as I do. And I have a special limited-time offer for my listeners. You get an entire month for free. But to start your free month, you have to sign up now with my special URL. So start your free month right now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. It was originally dedicated on the 20th of November, 1909. It was actually built many years before, back in 1837, under another name. Known previously as the Frontier, it was renamed in the early 20th century as the Gunter Hotel in San Antonio, Texas. The hotel was named after its primary investor, a man who went by the name Jot, J-O-T, Jot Gunter. Famous guests over the years have included classic film star Mae West, Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, even John Wayne stayed there. It's hosted former presidents, including Roosevelt and Truman. But this hotel, like many in that part of the country, has a darker side and a darker story. The year was 1965, the date February 2nd. A man checked into room 636 under the name Albert Knox. This eventually turned out to be an alias. He was a blonde man said to be about 28 years old. And over the next several days in the lobby of the hotel, he could be seen coming in and out, accompanied by a tall, sophisticated-looking blonde woman. All seemed normal until 6 days later. The afternoon turndown service knocked on the door to change the sheets and tidy up the hotel room. The housekeeper had seen the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, but it had been there for so long she figured it was simply an oversight, and so she turned the lock with her passkey. But as she walked into the room, she was shocked to discover Mr. Albert Knox standing beside a bed that was soaked in blood. The housekeeper froze in terror as Mr. Knox looked up and he put his index finger to his lips and said, "Shh." He then reached down, gathered up the blood-soaked bundle of sheets, and he ran right past her, out the door, down the hall, out of sight and away. The mortified housekeeper immediately ran from the room. She found the bellhop who told the manager, the entire hotel filled with the buzz of this story, the police arriving an eternal half hour later. and the detectives discovered a grisly scene in 636. The entire room covered in blood, almost as if it had been painted in blood. Blood on the carpet, blood on the walls, blood in the bathroom, blood everywhere. It was 2 days later when the cops finally tracked down a suspect who had checked in just a few blocks down the way at the St. Anthony Hotel. Believing this man to be the killer, they went and pounded on his door and immediately after heard a gunshot from inside the room. The dead man was identified as Walter Emery. Now you have to remember this time. This was before DNA evidence and proper crime scene investigation. This was more than half a century ago. The dark ages in terms of investigative science. But it was obvious that someone had been murdered. Likely this mysterious blonde woman who had kept the company of this mysterious blonde man, checking in under his mysterious alias at the Gunter Hotel. Most mysterious of all is that a body was never actually found. And long after, cold case investigators who were perusing the story theorized that the murderer may have disposed of the body within the still wet cement at a portion of the hotel that was at the time under construction. What an ingenious way to dispose of a body at this moment. Even now, it is said that this woman lies entombed in concrete, a part of the Gunter Hotel's very foundation. In the decades since this terrible murder, both employees and guests of the hotel report strange occurrences, almost all in the vicinity of room 636, and you can look these up on the internet if you like. Some people report seeing a restless person somewhat aglow. Others have seen a woman with her arms outstretched. Reported are the strange sounds of hammering coming from inside the room. A blonde woman inexplicably appearing in photographs that are taken of unrelated people. Housekeeping staff reportedly has trouble keeping people on the payroll because those who go in and clean 636 suddenly leave the room. They walk to the hall, they go into the elevator, they go outside and never return to work again. There are even some reports of an elderly woman, an old woman who lurks about the hotel, causing us to wonder if perhaps this once beautiful young woman has actually somehow aged in the afterlife. Since those days, the Gunter Hotel has undergone an $8 million renovation, and it's been absorbed into the Sheraton Hotel Group. Today, there are only 322 guest rooms and suites, furnished in the style of the old club rooms of the Texas cattlemen. It's fully updated, all the amenities of a full-scale modern hotel. But this ghostly legend remains, as do the stories of the murdered mystery woman and room 636 that was painted almost from top to bottom in someone's blood. The body in the concrete, under the floors, in the foundation, and the restless ghost that wanders nameless, forever anonymous, within the walls and halls and rooms of the old Gunter Hotel. San Antonio, Texas has a lot of wonderful haunted hotel stories. They're fun to peruse this time of year. Let's stay around that same relative time frame in our country's history, the mid-1900s. Before Henry Cavill, before Christopher Reeve, there was Superman, who was played by actor George Reeves during television's golden age. Superman was a celebrated television icon in 1950s America. But in real life, the actor who played him, George Reeves, was a troubled man who lived a troubled life, experienced a tragic death, and allegedly continues his unrest in a manner that only the undead can do among the living. But let's go back. Let's start at the beginning of this story. George Reeves was actually born George Brewer. His mom became pregnant outside of wedlock, a scandal during that time in our nation's history, in her hometown of Galesburg, Illinois. And so to avoid scandal, she eloped with her lover and moved to Iowa, where she finally had the baby 5 months into their marriage. The marriage itself was short, the divorce was hard, and Helen, a single mother, then took baby George and she moved to Pasadena, California. It was in his teens that George discovered his love of acting. He performed at the Pasadena Playhouse, and it was there he met his future wife, Eleanor. They married on the 22nd of September, 1940. They had no children. Their marriage lasted 10 years before they divorced in 1950. But while the marriage failed, George's career was actually beginning to soar. He was cast as Stuart Carlton in the 1939 David O. Selznick classic Gone with the Wind. It was a minor role, very minor, but it was a big break for him, and it opened all kinds of doors. One of those doors was an acting contract with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers changed his professional name from George Brewer to George Reeves. And he enjoyed screen time in some capacity with big stars of the time like James Cagney, Charlie Chan, even Ronald Reagan. George was drafted during the Second World War. He was assigned to the Air Force. He even performed for the Army and helped in promotion and doing training films for the Air Force. After an honorable discharge, he returned to Hollywood with hopes of great things. For years, he would find himself experiencing hints, flickers of greatness, and then languishing in long stretches of failure. But all of that would change in June of 1951. George Reeves was offered the role of a lifetime. The lead role on a television series called The Adventures of Superman. And George Reeves became a national celebrity and a household name by 1953. He was known everywhere he went. But after playing Superman week after week, he began to feel creatively unchallenged. He became embroiled in contract and other disputes with partners and friends. He experienced a measure of a kind of midlife burnout. George Reeves was far from the man of steel that he portrayed on television. He attempted various business ventures. He dated society playgirls. He tried to launch new acting projects. It seemed like nothing ever really stuck. It was on June 16th, 1959, between 1:30 and 2 in the morning, when the cops were called to George Reeves' home in Benedict Canyon. And they discovered in his room the body of George Reeves, with a gunshot wound to the head. There'd been a gathering that evening, many of the guests still in the home. They'd heard the single gunshot from downstairs, allegedly ran up into the room and found the body lying across the bed, naked. The official story is that George Reeves committed suicide after a series of personal and professional failures, and he simply lost his will to live. But that story has been challenged. In fact, his friend Rory Calhoun declared publicly that no one in Hollywood believed this claim of suicide. There was even a movie made about this story. It's a 2006 film called Hollywoodland. It stars Ben Affleck as George Reeves. There are moments in this story when truth blends with legend. Facts dissolve into fiction. It becomes so hard for those of us so many decades later to see through the fog back to 1959. The guests that night were allegedly intoxicated to the point of incoherence, absolutely drunk out of their minds. Could there have been an argument and one of them pulled the trigger? Some say that George Reeves used to play a macabre suicide game, a practical joke that he enjoyed that involved a gun loaded with a blank. Did someone replace the blank with an actual bullet? There are allegations that no powder burns were discovered on George Reeves' face, something that should have easily been recognized after a direct gunshot wound to the skull. Detectives allegedly reported an irregular entry and exit wound for a self-inflicted gunshot. It said that George Reeves' right hand had been disabled after a car wreck, a recent car accident. He'd crashed into a brick wall, and his right hand was disabled, and yet the gun had been fired with his right hand. These things remain a mystery, and George Reeves' body was exhumed and cremated in 1961, which makes this story just another unsolved Hollywood legend. And it is a ghostly legend. Because at the former house of George Reeves, ghostly phenomena have been reported ever since the day of his suicide in 1959. Occupants who've been in the house have been plagued by the sounds of echoes in the darkness, a male voice weeping, crying from behind the walls. A few have actually heard the sound of a gunshot from within. The lights will flicker, and the doors and furniture will move and act with a kind of agency that no one can explain. Some have even claimed to see George Reeves himself still at home walking the halls of his former house. Realtors have allegedly had problems selling the home, something they had been eager to do back in 1960 to settle many of George Reeves' debts. Occupants would report unexplainable noises. They would hear sounds specifically from within George Reeves' bedroom. The bedding would be torn off the bed. Clothing would be strewn about. Some would report an ominous smell, the smell of gunpowder. New occupants moved out so quickly, one couple didn't even last the first night. Even the neighbors reported seeing the visage of a man standing out on the front lawn, a man who bore the characteristics of George Reeves. Did he die of heartbreak and a self-inflicted gunshot wound? Or was his life stolen from him by someone who successfully covered their murder by making a Hollywood homicide a Hollywood suicide? You and I will likely never know. What we do know, unfortunately, tragically, is that while he may have played the Superman, the mortal man, George Reeves, was not faster than a speeding bullet. This isn't a ghost story, but it qualifies as a great campfire story, and so I will include it here. Written by Peter Coleman, it's called A Town Named 1234. The subtitle says, every town has a secret, and this one is no exception. There is a town not too far from here named 1234. And why is it called 1234? Well, for 99 years, the population of the town was 1,234 people. No more, no less. In the first dozen years or so of its existence, it was just a strange coincidence that the population always stayed at 1,234 residents. Except for 1 year. The town became a minor celebrity around the region because of the fuss the newspapers made about the town when it came time for the annual census. However, it wasn't every year that the number of children born and the number of people who died naturally balanced out to 1,234 people. Sometimes adjustments had to be made. If there were too many people, the town council would call a special session, and they'd vote to condemn someone's home, so those people would have to move out. When this happened 3 years in a row, the alarmed townsfolk demanded this practice be stopped. Members of the town council met secretly to explore ways of balancing the population, so it always remained at 1234, 1,234 residents. It just seemed every time there was a birth, someone died soon afterwards, and every time people moved away, others would become pregnant. The mayor's name was Cornelius Sawyer. He'd been the mayor for the last 34 years. Today, he's the patriarch of the large Sawyer family, 8 brothers and sisters. People say the only good thing about Cornelius Sawyer being the mayor is that whenever it looks like the town might not exactly have its 1,234 residents, then one or more of the Sawyer families will move into or out of town to make up the difference. But the town centennial arrived, And people had big plans for this 100-year celebration. They were expecting 10,000 visitors, and all the hotels everywhere in the town were booked up. It was a time of great anticipation and also great stress. One crisis was averted after old man Miller passed away from a heart attack just 2 weeks before the census was to be taken. However, Cornelius was able to talk unwed mother-to-be, Sherry Billings, who was pregnant, very pregnant with her child, into having a C-section just a little bit early. If she would do him this enormous favor, Cornelius said he would pay her hospital expenses in full, and after the baby was born and old enough, he promised her a job at the factory. It was an offer she couldn't resist. And so her early child would make up for the passing of old man Miller. And the population of this town would remain 1, 2, 3, 4. It was the night before the census in the upper room. The town council met secretly in the old town hall. Cornelius put the doctor on speakerphone.
"Good evening, everyone," said Dr. Taylor.
"Dr. Taylor, you said you had some news for all of us. Did Sherry have the baby?" asked Cornelius anxiously.
"No, things are doubly fine," the doctor said. "I just finished giving Sherry her final examination before I performed the C-section. However, I thought I'd let you all know that a trick's been played on me."
"What trick is that?"
"Well, it appears that someone's been playing hide-and-seek. Sherry's going to have twins. It seems one of the babies was hiding behind the other, and I just never heard its heartbeat until now."
"You hid this from us on purpose," shouted Cornelius.
"Oh, don't be ridiculous, Sawyer. Sherry Billings has been my patient since she was born. I'd never keep this information from her," said Dr. Taylor.
"Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm so sorry. I'm just upset. I'm not upset for myself. I'm upset for my town. Thank you for telling us this, and you make sure and give Sherry our very best wishes." And Cornelius hung up the phone. Many of the council members started to argue, but Cornelius said, "Settle down." Everybody settled down. He said, "Let's take a 15-minute recess." And many of the council members stepped outside while Cornelius, his brother Ed, and his business partner Ponner Barnes met in Cornelius's office. They shut the door. Cornelius leaned back in his chair and he said, "Look, I know exactly what we're going to do." 20 minutes later, Cornelius, Ed, and Barnes went back into the meeting chamber with the other council members. Everybody gathered again. Cornelius began to speak. "The news we all received is certainly a mixed blessing. It's wonderful news, of course, for Sherry, but it puts all of us in a perilous situation with the census if the reputation, if the celebrity of this town is going to be maintained. 1, 2, 3, 4 is what put us and keeps us on the map. We got to keep it that way." There was dead silence in the room. People seemed to realize that somebody among them, that very night, was likely going to die. A few moments passed, and Cornelius gathered his things together and continued. He said, "You know what? I've had a long and good life here in the town of 1, 2, 3, 4. I've built a pretty successful business, made some friends along the way. You all know my wife, Jenny, passed away years ago. And after that, well, the town became really the only thing that matters to me, the only thing that matters in my whole life. Now, my family, the Sawyer family, has had a long tradition of service to this town, going all the way back to the day it was founded. And we've sacrificed, as a family, greatly for this town. But don't think I'm complaining, folks, because I'm not. It's been an honor, really. It's been a personal pleasure to be your mayor and to serve this town for some 34 years. And now I think it's time for the Sawyers to make one more sacrifice for the sake of 1, 2, 3, 4. Therefore, I have decided
that I will have an accident tonight. There was a long pause. And then, all at once, everybody erupted in protest. No, you cannot do that. Save your own life. It's not worth it, they cried. Don't give your life for this town. It took a while for Cornelius to quiet the room. I've already made up my mind, folks. No one's going to talk me out of this. Now, Ed and Ponner and I have come up with a plan that'll truly make this look like an accident. And I promise everyone here, I promise you, I will feel no pain. As you know, Ed is the town mechanic. And he's simply going to go cut the brake line on a vehicle. And I'm going to be on foot. And I will cross the road at just the time the brakes on the vehicle fail. The car will hit me, and I'll be gone quick and painless. But we're going to need help. Ed and Ponner can't drive the car because that's going to raise some issues with the insurance companies. You know, since Ed is my brother and Ponner's my business partner, a little too close to home. We need someone more distant. We need some help to drive that vehicle. And we were thinking it should be you, Tom. Tom, who had been sitting silently, shook his head as if to awaken himself from sleep. You want me? Why me? Ed spoke up and said, your truck is pretty beat up and it's parked at the top of the hill right outside the building. Now, your truck did just pass inspection, so you'd never be liable. If anything, I'd be liable since I'm the one who did the inspection. Tom said, what, you mean we have to do this now? No, I'm going to need some time to think about this. Cornelius interrupted him. There's no time to think, Tom. There's no time. It's got to happen, and it's got to happen now. Look, it's already 11 p.m. It's almost midnight. Let's go, Tom. You just got to start the truck up, point it down the hill, and I'll be right there at the bottom of the hill waiting. You can close your eyes if you need to. Listen, I don't like this any more than you do. And we wouldn't be in this mess if Sherry wasn't going to have twins, but we've got to face reality. One person has to be sacrificed tonight, and it's going to be me, one way or the other. And the men stood up and walked toward the door, and you could hear some of the council members begin to cry as they stepped outside to the truck. And the council members crowded from inside, pressing their faces against the windows to watch what would happen next. Tom sat behind the steering wheel of the truck for several minutes. The council members could see him through the window, through his own windshield, and he just sat there. And finally he bowed his head inside the truck, and it looked as if he was saying a prayer. And then he took out his key, and he put it in the ignition, and he turned the key, and boom! His truck exploded into flames. Cornelius walked past the burning truck, back through the door of the building, back into City Hall, with Ed and Ponner following behind. When they entered the chamber, all was quiet. Cornelius spoke up and said to Ed in a loud voice, you were supposed to cut the brake line, not the fuel line. Cornelius's eyes then scanned the room, looking everybody in the eye, and with what looked like the faintest wry little smile, he said, well, I guess this kind of accident could happen to just about anyone. And it was just then that the phone rang, and one of the council members walked over and answered it. A few seconds passed, and she put the phone back on the receiver and walked back to the group. Finally, she spoke. She said that was Dr. Taylor. He said Sherry had her babies just a minute ago.
One was delivered stillborn.
I'd like to thank my friends on Facebook, those who follow me on social media and connect with me there, for adding their assistance in the fleshing out of this final story. It's a somewhat original tale that speaks to some common childhood fears, something I think many of us can relate to. But I had just hit a block in putting the final pieces of the puzzle together, and so I shamelessly went on Facebook Live, and we created a collaborative experience in figuring out how to sort of tie all this together. So if you were one of those people on Facebook, thank you so much. You are a big part of what our listeners are about to hear. It is the story of a little boy facing his fears. Alone in his bedroom, the story is called The Dead Under the Bed. His mother and father assured Daniel, "It's okay. You're a big boy now. You can sleep in your own room now. There's no need to keep crawling in with mommy and daddy every single night. Daniel, you've got your own bedroom. You've got your own bed. You're totally safe. There's no need to be afraid. You are a big boy." But Daniel was just a little boy. He didn't feel like a big boy. And he'd always been afraid of the thing that he felt was just under his bed. He'd sensed it for so long, before he ran down the hall every single night, before he escaped into his parents' room, he could hear it, or he thought he could hear it, shuffling and shifting and moving under the mattress and the box spring and the bed frame. It was there. Every night it was there. "Daniel, you are sleeping in your own room tonight. Come on, the night light's on, you're totally safe, and you can't sleep in our bed anymore, and that's it, okay? It's time for you to grow up just a little bit." And so he did. It was almost midnight. Daniel had not slept a wink. He hadn't moved. And those sounds from beneath his bed, those sounds began again. That wasn't Daniel's breathing. "I don't believe in you. Go away," he said. "I don't believe in you. Just go away." And as he lay there, flat on the bed itself, the entire bed lifted an inch off of the ground. It hovered in space and then slowly sat back down upon the carpet. "I don't believe in you. I don't believe in you. Go away." And the bed lifted again, even higher this time, 12 inches. Maybe even 18 inches straight up toward the ceiling, and then it held and went back down again. "Stop it. Just stop it. What do you want?" There was breathing again, but this time there was something more. How does an 8-year-old process this? Daniel did not process it. In mind and in body, he just closed in on himself.
"I am the dead under the bed."
Daniel heard footsteps outside his bedroom door, Surely his mother and father had heard this thing, this unnatural sound, and they were coming to the rescue. Footsteps coming closer, closer. But then disappearing down the hall. Somebody was just going to the kitchen? How could they not know? How could they not hear? Please don't hurt me.
Get buried. Lost. Hear me. Hear me. Hear me.
Daniel was paralyzed. The nightlight on the outlet pulsed with energy. Its light somehow magnified a dozen times so that Daniel had to turn his eyes away. And the bed started to rattle. And the shadows cast throughout the room, detached from the objects that sourced them. The shadows came alive. They slithered on the floor toward Daniel's bed. They tangled and intertwined. They twisted and joined and drifted underneath the bed. And the room bathed in the white, hot light emanating from this tiny little bulb on the wall. But the shadows were like solid objects beneath the mattress. He could hear them. He could feel them. His books on the bookshelf began to shake. Adventure books and comic books and coloring books and picture books. They danced out of their slots between the bookends and fell down to the floor. The pages ripped from within the bindings, one page after the other. Dozens, hundreds, thousands of little pages tumbling and tossing in space. There was an array of finger paints on the nightstand. The canisters of paint opened up and every one of the seven colors spilled out onto the floor. And they mixed together into a bluish black and then splashed upon the pages as they twirled and spun and molded and curled themselves into shapes. Small shapes turning into large shapes which became two enormous legs. Shiny, with a gloss of bluish black the size of the trunks of trees. The floor lamp tumbled and shattered, the long brass cylinder thrusting into the left side of its torso, the wood frame from a wall painting disassembling in space and then connecting and jamming into its right, the arms, as it were, twitching robotically. This headless figure was already so tall as to crush the light fixture on the ceiling. The bulb shattering, the window on the wall shattering, a small branch of the nearby elm tree twisting into a ball, the twig snapping with the strain into a jumble of pressurized wood the size of a medicine ball. A giant orb with three equally sized holes serving as the eyes and mouth, gaping as if in great pain. Looming over the top of Daniel's head so that he felt he might be swallowed whole. This thing looked as if someone had painted a nightmare in three vivid dimensions. But when Daniel saw the creature's reflection in his bedroom mirror, he did not see the beast. He saw a little boy. A little boy that looked almost exactly like him. It was a mirror in every relevant sense of the word. Daniel did not understand. Daniel did not want to stand up.
Stand. Stand.
Daniel obeyed. And as he almost disappeared under the looming shape of randomness and darkness that nearly suffocated this bedroom, he looked up, way up, to meet the thing at what were obviously supposed to be its eyes. It breathed and heaved. It loomed and shuddered. It thrust out its twisty upper limbs as Daniel screamed. He screamed so loud. Mother and father had indeed heard commotion. They were already struggling to open the door, but they were locked in the hallway and absolutely helpless. The giant arms closed inward, inward, inward. But instead of crushing the boy's tiny body to death, the arms gently enveloped him, wrapped around him like a warm blanket. And with that touch came a sensation not of terror and revulsion, but of heartache and desperate yearning and compassion and even trust. The thing pulled away from him, heaved as if strained, and gently pushed Daniel's bed away from its resting place against the center of the west wall. At the old wooden slat floor, it pointed down. At a single spot, it pointed down and said nothing. Daniel slowly knelt down to that very spot. He brushed away the toys and socks and debris that had found their way under the bed over the days, and he noticed something right there in the wood. He noticed an imperfection in the lining of the slats. With his fingers, he reached down and he tried to pry the boards loose, but his fingernails nearly tore at the effort. He looked at this thing above him for assistance, but it stood deathly still. This task was apparently Daniel's to undertake, and he would do it alone. Daniel scrambled to his closet and grabbed the dull scissors resting in his box of crafts, and he worked the blades between the boards, slowly getting purchase, slowly prying the lid from the secret which had been sleeping underneath him for all of these years. And after great effort, the floorboards finally surrendered, and Daniel discovered underneath a small metal box. There was no latch, there was no lock. It simply rested closed under the weight of an 8-inch lid. Daniel pulled it into the light and he opened it. Inside was a series of photographs. Photographs of his parents. His parents holding not only their child, Daniel, but twins. Twin boys. Scribbled on the white border of the second Polaroid were names, Daniel and David. Brothers. Daniel knew of no brother. He remembered no brother. His parents had spoken of no brother. The boy just sat there in disbelief. This entire time, his parents, just a few feet away outside the sealed door, were still pounding and yelling and screaming to get inside. But Daniel did not move toward them. The dead under the bed loomed over him like a mountain. It made the most unnerving, most unnatural utterance of grief. And then it erupted. The box spilled its secrets all over the room and tumbled into the corner, where its underside revealed something not before seen. It was a shape, painted onto the bottom of the box, a shape. A red star with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... points. At that very second, Daniel's bedroom door crashed open, and his parents stood mortified in the shadow of the thing as it twisted slowly to face them. The sockets of the creature's eyes held an intensity of rage that cannot be fully described. And Daniel watched helplessly from the corner at what happened next. No one said a word. The thing's enormous frame bent down, way down, its limbs and makeshift fingers fumbling for something, finding something. The photograph. And it folded Daniel out of the image, so that only David remained. And it pressed that photograph against the place on its chest where a human heart might reside. "It had to be done," the mother suddenly spoke. "You were the chosen. One must die. One must live. It is the old way." The father's mouth finally opened. "Devil, we call upon you. Protect us. Save us. We are your servants in blood and pain and glory. Beg the devil. Gain his power. Live until the angels cower. Pleasure, measure, power, vice, paid with human sacrifice." Daniel no longer saw a mother and a father. Those who stood now in his doorway were strangers to him. He had a brother. He was a brother. He looked at them, and the words suddenly thundered out of his mouth. "Why?" "Don't be afraid, Daniel. It was for the best. David was a gift. He was an offering, so that all of us could live. To live as without time, to live as gods. It was so long ago, honey, you never even knew him. You didn't even know him, you can't even remember him. This is how it had to be, Daniel." Daniel's quiet home had borne and buried this unspeakable secret for years. A secret yearning to be known. A secret that stretched through the plains to move and ruffle and rattle the real world. A secret that needed to be heard by a little boy so innocent, so unaware of the dark power that surrounded him. Daniel slowly stood up. The dead under the bed stood between them. And Daniel spoke to it directly this time, without fear. It took a moment before Daniel realized that the thing now held his mother and father by the throat. They gasped and they pounded and they flailed their twisted mouths, shouting, "Save us, Lord! Save us, Lord! Dark Lord, we serve you! We serve you! We serve only you!" The 20 feet leading into the parents' bedroom saw a trail of debris. Family photos pounded from the walls. Holes in the sheetrock, shattered glass. This mother and father would not go quietly, but go they did. No dark protector arrived, no lord, no master. As the thing's smallest vines and branches shot from its body and enveloped the man and woman, binding them as a spider would bind its prey, and they laid on the bed, screaming toward the ceiling. The dead under the bed spoke.
"Take them. Release us."
The master bedroom was, in an instant, painted in blood. Blood oozing upward on the walls, as if each blood cell had a consciousness of its own. A crimson lake about a half inch deep flowing now beneath their feet. Blood oozing down the bedroom door, the closet door, the bathroom door, the windows. There was the smell of sulfur and smoke filling the room. Suddenly the echoes of the damned. And walking toward them from the black of the corner, they saw a form without skin, only pulsing muscle and vein, as black as midnight, except for the eyes and the teeth, which were white like neon. There were tiny veins moving around its tissues, like tiny worms, electrified. It had three large fingers, drawing into four-inch claws. Dozens of flies, hundreds of flies, seemed to have landed upon it and buzzed around it. It smelled of rotten meat and feces and smoke and death. It oozed a sinister intelligence and mischief and power and rage and delight. The rancid figure, summoned to this moment of judgment, looked at the thing, at the boy, and down at the two figures on the beds who still struggled in their bindings.
Why should I settle for them when I can have all of you?
It was looking at David. And the dead under the bed stood in front of little Daniel, like a shield, protecting him.
Take me. Release him.
Little bits of flame shot out of the walls. The stench of death and rot was overwhelming. The screaming from the couple on the bed grew even louder. Even louder than the sound of Daniel's own pounding heart.
Take me. Release him.
The devil braced and bristled, squaring its black, fleshy shoulders against the frame of the dark thing in front of it. It slowly shook its head in a kind of resigned acceptance. And then it shouted in both laughter and in sorrow. And this devil turned toward the couple on the bed. From its mouth drifted a long, snaky tongue that slithered over their sweaty skin and their many tears, tasting the feast before it would be devoured. And then the mother and father stiffened in a kind of black light, both dark and blinding, coming from below them. Their bodies tore from the center, the skin peeling back like that of a grape, the heart and the lungs still moving, still heaving, as the human forms inverted upon themselves, fully inside out. And with a wry smile, the devil winked. And in a flash of crimson and pain and deafening noise, the room was again still. There was Daniel. There was David. No longer the hideous thing, but the innocent boy, breathing the air, existing in space and time, for the first time since so very long ago. And the brothers looked each other squarely in the eye, saying nothing. It appears there is something that the devil himself cannot overcome. It is not the power of God, whoever that might be. It is not the power of evil, whatever that might be. But bonds so strong, a love so strong, that one would be willing to sacrifice everything to save another. I am the dead under the bed. I am the secret left unsaid. Hopeless, hopeless, murdered child, offered while the elders smiled. Brothers, brothers, justice, peace, feel the spirit free at least. Far above the crimson coal, brothers, brothers, now made whole. And with the room still laced in fire and smoke spilling through the corners of the upstairs windows to the outside, the boys heard sirens approaching. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful October holiday season and a happy Halloween.